Thank you very much, and thank you to CEDA for inviting me here today. I think this is an important conference and I'm very pleased to be part of it. Well, what I want to talk about in this presentation, I only have 15 minutes, but I think I want to stress at the very beginning that if we're talking about the sort of reductions, cuts in emissions that the scientists are telling us, we're talking about a fairly major transformation of the world economy. And in designing policies to undertake that transformation, we have to be extremely careful how we go about it in terms of the incentives we create, the institutions we put in place, and the timing under which we're going to actually achieve these deep cuts in emissions. What I want to do in this brief presentation is actually just stress the importance of prices, why they have to be at the core of a climate change policy or portfolio of policies. I want to set out what I think the core of the debate is. We've already started to hear that from Shapiro. Then I want to stand back and ask the question, well, we've tried to do this sort of stuff before, not on climate policy, but we've tried to manage the world economy when it comes to monetary cooperation. And we learned a lot because we made major mistakes. There are a few things that we need to understand. And one is that it's going to have to be a cooperative approach, not a centralised approach that we come up with. It will not come from the top down. It has to be countries cooperating. I then want to very briefly set out what is an approach that's in between a carbon tax and a permit trading system that deals with all of Robert Shapiro's complaints, and then make the final point, in case you leave before I'm finished, that you should run climate policy like we run monetary policy, and there's a reason for that. Why do energy prices matter? Why do economists worry about prices? This figure shows you three lines. This is an index from set at 1 in 1965. The green line is GDP. The red line is energy use and the blue line is CO2 emissions. You can see leading up until the early 70s, energy use was running ahead of GDP. In the early 70s, something fundamental changed, and for the next two or three decades, we have a different world. What changed? The price of energy. The price of energy changed, people changed the demand for energy, the way they used energy, the way they produced energy. It was a major transforming event in the global economy. Some people will say, no, this is not prices, this is regulation. This is the US Congress stepped in, California stepped in, CAFE standards were introduced. Well, that's the same chart for Japan. The US Congress wasn't running Japan, if I recall. This was a serious shock to the world economy. All economies that have experienced the change in the price of energy experienced the same fundamental transformation in the way that energy used to produce GDP. So the question is, I think there's no debate that we shouldn't have a price. The question is, how do you set a price? And there are three different cores to the debate. You can pick a target for emissions, either nationally or internationally. You can have a permit trading system or some other regulatory framework, and that in itself will produce a price. And this is called the quantity approach. This is, in Shapiro's language, the cap and trade system is the most popular approach, and that is the Kyoto Protocol approach. The alternative is to pick a price for emissions, where you try and line up the price with the expected benefits. And the benefit of this is you know exactly what it's going to cost, but the problem is that emissions could be whatever they are in any particular year. There's no way of constraining emissions. This is fundamentally the tax approach to climate policy. But in fact, you can take the best features of both of these, discard the worst features of both of these, and create a hybrid system, which is actually a long-term carbon target with long-term trading markets, but a short-term control of the price of carbon. And that is the approach in the McKibben-Wilcoxon blueprint, and that's underlying the Prime Minister's Task Group on Emissions Trading's recent report. Now, prices are important, but not any price will matter. And I've heard a number of people saying that you can't get a high enough short-term price to cause any effect. Well, the key point to recognise is it's not the short-term price that really matters. It's the long-term price. The short-term price matters in terms of economic costs. It's the long-term price that matters for stimulating the investment in alternative technologies, both on the demand side and the supply side. If you don't have credible price signals, you won't get the investment forthcoming. And these price signals, as I said, have to operate not just on how you produce energy, but they have to operate throughout the entire economy, in the global economy, the behaviour and the decisions of billions of people. Where we want to focus on in policy design is to minimise the short-term costs, but give the biggest, most powerful price signal to stimulate investment that we possibly can. Now, we can learn a lot from what we've done in monetary history over the last 50 years in particular. And one thing we do know is every time we try and create a single world currency, it doesn't work. And I'll talk briefly as to why that's the case. And just from that experience alone, it's pretty clear to me is we'll never have a global system with a global price set through a global market we'll have a series of national markets where we coordinate the common price. So why don't I think a global permit market would work? And that's basically because an emission permit is fundamentally the promise of a government. And the trouble is that governments have different degrees of credibility and different incentives. And we've seen in the European trading system the incentives in governments' allocation mechanisms, etc. So governments will always be reacting, and they will behave differently, and different parties within a country have different incentives. So I just don't see that you can end up with a global permit market. If you try and do it, it could possibly work, but you'll end up with the same outcome as the gold standard or the Bretton Woods system. So my view is that climate policy should be like monetary policy, and the key issue here is credibility. Whatever is done, it has to be credible, because we're talking about a long-term problem that requires long-term investments, that requires a belief in exactly what might be happening in the future. And we've learned a lot from monetary policy, in fact, that we used to target the stock of money. And we targeted the stock of money, and the short-term interest rate went up and down, and we actually got no conceivable gains from that volatility in interest rates whatsoever. And we abandoned the idea of targeting the stock of money, and we switched to targeting the short-term interest rate. And the way that works is we tie down the long-term expectations in the economy through fiscal rectitude. We have a very clear fiscal framework in many countries now, and we have very clear targeting of inflation by central banks, perfectly consistent targets, very transparent, priced in financial markets of very long duration, long-term bond markets, foreign exchange markets. So the government has somebody watching them all the time, and their policies are being evaluated all the time. Now, we can apply exactly the same idea to climate policy, where we have a short-term price target, like a tax, but not necessarily a tax, and a clear long-run policy goal where we're guiding through markets, pricing and evaluating our credibility to these deep cuts at some point in the future. How do we incorporate this into an actual policy? Well, the McKibben-Wilcoxon blueprint, we start with a long-term goal for economies. We generate a long-term price to guide the energy-related investment decisions. We line up the short-term economic costs with the expected environmental benefits by using a price cap or a safety valve. We then also, by creating these markets, we're also creating capacity for risk management by corporations and individuals. And finally, we would take this at the national level and plug each one of these programs together to create a global system with a global price at the core. So very quickly, what are the components and how does this work? Well, firstly, you have to constrain that you have an emission permit to emit carbon within a national border. And then you create what we call long-term permits. These long-term permits are actually a bundle of permits with a date for every year that can only be used within that year. The number of these long-term permits you give out is the long-term goal for policy, and the amount of emissions for each dated permit is actually declining over time. And then you would trade these in a market. So in this graph, this would be a typical permit that the Labor Party might introduce if they adopted our approach. This is a long-term permit that gives you an annual permit every year that gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So by 2050, there's only 60% of the permits that were there in 2010. Having this sharp decline in a credible, committed property right that's in a market means that the price of this thing is likely to be rising sharply over time. The second component of the permit policy is that we introduce a second set of a lot of permits, which are called annual permits. These annual permits are only introduced in a given year, and they evaporate at that end of that year. And the government says we'll supply as many of these annual permits as you need at a guaranteed price. So this is like setting the interest rate, that the price will never rise above this particular permit price. This is a safety valve. What does it look like in practice? Well, here's one scenario where we announce the permit price at $10 per tonne of carbon at the beginning, and after 5 years we discover we weren't hitting our target, so we lift the cap and we lift the cap and we lift the cap. So this is a short-term carbon price, no volatility, smooth transition through time. This is what the emissions would look like in Australia. Again, this is the target, the blue line. The red triangles are the reset period for the safety valve, and the pink lines are the actual emissions. And the gap between the two are the allocation of short-term permits that the market needed in this scenario, because they ran into the cost constraint. In fact, they run into the cost constraint continuously, so there's no volatility. And you can see that by learning by doing, by ratcheting up the price in this scenario, we eventually hit our long-term target and we eventually address the deep cut scenario. These permits, though, are being priced not only today, but there's a market pricing them across the entire yield curve for 100 years, and they're very valuable assets. Here's an example of a single permit that started off at $10 per tonne and is actually worth more than $1,000 in this particular market. So therefore, yeah, this is a very quick introduction into how you design a market to operate climate policy like monetary policy. And just to draw the analogy together, we have the long-term bond market is just like a long-term permit market, where we have a given supply of bonds and a given supply of long-term permits. The central bank controls the short-term interest rate. A central bank of carbon would control the short-term carbon price, and the liquidity, or the number of emissions in a given year, would move up and down with demand. And we know that the long-term carbon price is the expected future value of short-term carbon prices. But critical to having this system operating is to set up an independent central bank of carbon who manages the policy. And you do this in each country, you plug it together, and the common factor is the common price. So this delivers an outcome like a global carbon tax, except most of the revenue in this system goes to the holders of the long-term permits within the economies, not to the government. And the reason for doing that is you want those who are doing the abatement actions to get the revenue. You don't want it to pass through the hands of the government, who then will allocate to any arbitrary program they think that the Shapiros or others of the world will actually want to direct the money into. We want to keep as much as possible in the market, in the hands of those who are innovating, with a little bit of tax at the margin for the annual permit sales. And you can find more details at my website. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Alan. Ladies and gentlemen, I think the this session was advertised as a debate between Warwick and I, and I was rather looking forward to debating Warwick, but as you can see, it's a bit hard to have a debate with another economist with whom you almost agree. Now, instead of having a debate, what I thought I'd do is make a few fundamental, what I think are fundamental points about some of the issues that have been raised and what we need to do to address this particular problem. And there have been several questions raised in the audience over the last couple of days that I don't think have quite yet been answered. I wouldn't be arrogant enough to suggest that I have those answers, but there's a couple of things I want to say to try and get the thing moving along. The first point that Warwick made, I think, is a very pertinent point, and that is that the amount of economic transformation that you have to do in the world economy to solve this problem is enormous. And I just don't think that most people understand the extent to which we have to transform the world economy to do this, basically. Now, just, I know it's very difficult to understand these numbers, but if you think just alone about carbon dioxide from the energy system, probably you have to strip out about 70 gigatons of CO2 in 2100 out of what would have otherwise been there. And most of these model estimates that we're using to get that number are projecting, in that reference case, massive increases in energy efficiency as we go through time. These things are not static. They're assuming 1 or 1.2% increases in energy efficiency year on year, constantly over the next 100 years. So these are not static models, and what we're asking the world economy here to do is an enormous task. And that's on CO2 alone from the energy system. And if you look at the base year inventory for non-energy greenhouse gases, there's about 20 gigatons of non-energy CO2, non-energy greenhouse gases in CO2 equivalent terms in the base, and you have to get rid of that as well. And these are really intransigent gases. Now, let me just name one for you. When we do a whole bunch of insulation in buildings, we use a lot of blown foam. Now, and that contains a whole lot of greenhouse gases with very, very high global warming potentials. When we do these metrics, global warming potentials, if Ron Prin is in the audience, he'll chastise me later for using a GWP because they're very approximate and quite bad from a scientific point of view. But from a practical policy point of view, it's not a bad way of adding up the different greenhouse gases. Now, these things have global warming. CO2 has a global warming potential of 1. Some of these other gases have global warming potentials of 36,000. And we have, in other words, 1 tonne of these things is equivalent to 36,000 tonnes of CO2 in terms of radiative forcing. In buildings today, we have an enormous bank of foam, basically as insulation, that's holding these industrial gases in place. As soon as we pull those buildings down, as soon as we pull the insulation out, we disturb that foam bank and we release that stuff to the atmosphere. So it's just not the case that you can do these things, you can transform buildings, for example, without having an impact on the base level of emissions that we have to control. This is a big problem. When we look at the energy system in the world, and we take this is a reasonable metric, we take the amount of carbon we release per unit of GDP, and let's assume we can measure that in purchasing power parity terms in reasonably accurately. If you look at those numbers, as best they can be calculated by economic historians, since 1850, we've been decarbonising the world economy by about 0.3% per annum over the long term, out to about 2000. And why have we been doing that? Well, it's pretty easy to think about that. Before the Industrial Revolution, we burnt mostly wood and biomass. And if you take wood, there are 10 atoms of carbon to every atom of hydrogen. And we progressed through the system. We use coal, we use oil, and now we like to use natural gas. Natural gas is one atom of carbon for four atoms of hydrogen. So in other words, we are basically decarbonising the energy as a consequence of changes in the fuel that we're using, and we're on the way to the hydrogen economy down there at 2050 or 2070 or something, where we've got just hydrogen, basically. So we've completely decarbonised the energy system, and that's where we've got to get if we're going to solve this problem. Now, if you look at, and there, I know there are the occasional person in the room that don't like the IPCC very much, but there are some good things in some IPCC reports if you look carefully, I submit, as at least one of the authors. I don't guarantee that there's all of it's good. I'm just saying that there are some good things there. Now, if you look at the Working Group 3 Summary for Policymakers, you'll find in the front of that, and this is up on the web, a nice graph that shows you the level of decarbonisation per unit of GDP expressed in PPP terms since about 1974, and you'll notice that we have stopped decarbonising the economy. We have stopped decarbonising the world economy. And the reason for that is, among other things, that China is growing at 11% per annum, and a massive proportion of the energy being used now, a massive proportion of the increase, is coming from coal, and that's very carbon intensive. So we've got off that trend. So what that means basically is we have a fundamentally difficult problem. And what we need here, not only do we need an ETS properly designed, as Warwick has been talking about, but we also need an enormous amount of extra expenditure on R&D, because if we don't get it, there's no way that we're going to have enough technology to suck off the shelf with Warwick's price. Yes, we need a price signal, but unless we have the technology to suck off the shelf, we're not going to be able to do the job. Now, the purist would say, well, if you see the price signal, then everybody will rush about and do the necessary investment to make sure that this happens. I'm not necessarily convinced about that. I think basically what we need is a combination of the price signal and some decent R&D expenditure. Now, how much of that do we need? Well, that's sort of an open guess, but I think we need a fair bit. What is the price that we need to get some of these technologies into the mix? I think somebody asked yesterday, when does carbon capture and storage become commercial? Now, of course, that depends on how good the scientists are out there in sorting out the technology, but today the best estimate we have is that you need a carbon tax of about $40 a tonne CO2 to bring the first tonne of CCS in. And believe me, if we're going to do this job, we need an enormous amount of carbon capture and storage in the next 50 years to do this job. We cannot do it without applying every technology, including nuclear and carbon capture and storage. It just cannot be done. if you do the numbers. And you, and what are we talking about when we're talking about, I think I heard Robert Shapiro talk about a carbon tax to do the whole job of $50 a ton of carbon. Well, that's, I'm afraid, that's just too low. It's not happening. It's not happening at that price. And this is one of the single problems we have with the documents and the estimates in the IPCC Working Group 3 report. They have reported very low numbers indeed in terms of the cost of doing this job. Now, why have they done that? It's not because anybody has gone out and been scurrilous in terms of doing the modelling, and I certainly wouldn't say that because I'm at least responsible for some of that modelling. It's because what's happened is that the majority of those models have assumed that from 2010 every country is engaged in the process and every country has put in a perfect policy, probably a carbon tax or an emissions trading scheme, and we have abated such that carbon price everywhere in the world against every industry is the same. We've basically set the price equal to the marginal cost of abatement. We've got the solution and we've assumed that the world is perfect. Now, I would be the first to admit, and I'm sure you'll all agree with me, that the world is not perfect. We struggle. We will struggle for many, many years to have a sensible international emissions trading scheme because you need proper compliance and monitoring. Now, I won't name any country, but you can just think about them. Do you really believe that even if we were to agree that we were going to do this immediately from 2010, and there's no way that's going to happen, and I'll come to that in a moment, that we can get perfect compliance in an emissions trading scheme across the planet? No, we can't. Do you really believe that you can get perfect tax compliance? No, you can't. It's impossible. So those estimates are massive underestimates of the cost of doing this job and the price of carbon we need where it will be applied. Now, do we believe that we can get this process in place by 2010? Well, lots of people hope we can, but we're not going to. Practically, it's impossible. And you only have to read the convention and the protocol to understand why. And I think I've got a protocol and a convention here. Beautiful documents, you should read them. You should get them off the web and read them. And if you don't believe what I'm saying to you about the difficulty associated with these negotiations, then I suggest, in terms of the protocol that you read, Article 3.9 and Article 10, which will basically tell you that the negotiations under the protocol for a second commitment period preclude the possibility of engagement of developing countries in taking on targets. It precludes it legally. Okay, so you're not doing that under the protocol. So this leaves you with the convention. And the convention, if you want to see the difficulties associated with negotiations under the convention in terms of engaging developing countries, then I suggest you read Articles 4.1, 3, 5 and 7 of the convention, and that will give you cause for pause with respect to the difficulty that our ambassador for the environment faces when she goes to international negotiations. These are really difficult negotiations, and this thing is going to take 20 or 30 years before you get action at the international level in a harmonised sort of way. So what are we talking about here? Basically, we're talking about Australia doing the best it can, designing a domestic emissions trading scheme that will take us forward, but we shouldn't fool ourselves that we're going to have the rest of the world on board all that quickly. Now, just let me, Mr. Chairman, I know you want to drag me off here almost instantaneously, but let me make one more point, and that is it's absolutely crucial that everybody in this room engages in the design of a proper emissions trading scheme. Warwick's already engaged. But what have we had? I mean, this is the first time in 20 years I've actually been able to stand on a stage during an election campaign and a caretaker period and actually say something about government policy. Now, in the last 3 or 4 weeks, I've only got a minute, but this is worth waiting for. In the last 3 or 4 weeks, we've had a lot of people saying a lot of stuff about greenhouse policy. And we know that no matter what happens on the 24th of November, we're going to have an emissions trading scheme in Australia, and I agree with that. We should do something about this. But we shouldn't stuff it up. So what have we done? What have we done in the last little while? Well, one of the things we've done, but not me, but some persons out there who are engaged in the political process, one lot have said that they would, not only will they have an emissions trading scheme, but they will, in addition to that, whack on a 20% renewable target by 2020. And, of course, people have said, yes, well, actually, that's a really good thing. That will generate jobs. Well, let me tell you, that is a terrible thing. This is one of the worst pieces of public policy you can ever imagine. Why do I say that? That is because an emissions trading scheme, a properly designed scheme, will deliver you the right amount of abatement without the additional cost of regulation. Regulation, every piece of economic literature ever written basically shows that regulation is more costly than market mechanisms. Let me give you some estimates, Mr. Chairman, before I end. And I know you've been very tolerant with me. We did some calculations recently about the cost of the Labor renewable energy target imposed on top of an emissions trading scheme. And what we did was we said, let's hit the same level of abatement. In other words, we hold the environmental outcome the same, so we let an emissions trading scheme do the job, or we let an emissions trading scheme and the renewables target do the same job. In other words, we've held the environment the same. The combination of those two policies will cost us, in according to the estimates, in 2020, $1.5 billion loss in GDP and 3,600 jobs. We will lose 3,600 jobs because we're doing this job less efficiently than we would if we let the market work. Not only do we do the job less efficiently, we actually take out around about 19,000 gigawatt hours of gas out of the system. We don't take coal out, we take gas out. So we actually take we've been trying to get the fuel mix towards that fuel that contains more hydrogen and less carbon, and by doing these regulations we actually make it worse. Now tell me, why on God's earth would we agree with that? Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
You can see why I was a little apprehensive about having to replace Mr. McCran as chairman of these two. Thank you very much. Well, both of you have underlined something which I think is apparent and can be concluded from our previous presentations, and that one of the things we seem to be drowning in with the effort to try to do something about climate change is bad public policy. We don't have one bad proposition in front of us on the table, Brian. We have two. Because the scheme that the government's put up, the one he referred to as a scheme that's been put up by the Labor Party, the scheme that the government's put up, which is purportedly to use the market to regulate emissions, has got so many conditions and qualifications in it that it won't be actually the market who will determine that scheme. It'll be the regulator. I made a throwaway before about the East German economic command and control model, and someone took issue with me and said, how could I say such a radical thing? I said, go and read the government's paper and see who actually in the Australian system, which they're envisaging, will determine who can have permits, who can't, how long they're going to be there for, and what they're going to be doing, and worse, which industry is actually going to be applying the technology which at that time the regulator will determine is the most appropriate low emissions technology. In other words, the so-called market system is going to rest on the determination by a regulator of what is the right technology. It'll be a very half-assed market system. But I think what's interesting from earlier discussions is that it seems our European friends are facing similar problems. So, gentlemen, the question I'd like to ask you is, how do we get out of this conundrum of such bad policy, and why is it happening? And then I'll throw it to the audience for questions.
Maybe. Can you hear me?
Yes. Well, Brian probably is better to answer that because he's on the inside of a lot of these decisions and I'm just a mere academic on the outside. But from what I can tell is there's the fundamental problem is no one has made a commitment yet to take action on climate change seriously. So there's no credible commitment by a government to really do the sort of cuts that are possibly required. Secondly, without a system in place, you're always going to get vested interests lobbying for the system which they prefer in their own self-interest. And you see that coming out in the Prime Minister's Emissions Trading Review. I actually like that document in many senses because it's based on my work. The difference is there's a few compromises in there which I don't like. For example, where the government has these aspirational targets, I'd like to have a perspirational target. I want a real target, not one which I can change every 5 years. So they've got this 5-year window which I don't like. Why would you relax the constraint with some probability? It undermines the credibility of the commitment and therefore reduces the long-term carbon price. So there's a few things like that which I think aren't necessary but were compromises in the process. But the basic idea behind the Emissions Trading Task Group, I think, is right, that you do have to have some sort of long-term goal and you do have to have a safety valve. They're the two key parts. Manage the costs, but have a credible long-term target which you're trying to achieve.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not on the inside, so I don't know what goes on the inside. I think the reason we get to these circumstances in public policy is that, in the end, public policy is developed by politicians and there's always compromise. It's almost impossible to find perfect public policy. But that doesn't mean that we should stop debating this issue. We should actually try and work the worst of this stuff away. And frankly, adding a whole bunch of regulations on top of a market mechanism is not the best thing we could do. So we should get rid of those things. For example, the notion that we should ban incandescent light bulbs, that's really bad public policy. Basically, what we should do is introduce the price mechanism and smart metering so people can see the price that they face and then let the consumer make up their own mind about the best way to reduce their emissions. That's what we should be doing. And in addition to that, of course, if there are some sort of impediments in the way of consumers getting options that they want to introduce for themselves, if they're prepared to pay for it, then they should be allowed to have them. But we don't do that. We would rather have command and control type approaches from Canberra because it's easy and it plays well in the community, basically. But it's time that we had a proper open debate about this stuff so we get a bit better transparency.
Okay, now because you two were so informative and so persuasive, we've let you go on a little bit expensive time for questions. We've got time for at least a couple of quick questions. Yes, there. And then you.
Thank you. Steve Hatfield from CSRO. So, Brian, you in a fit of optimism at one point said the market will deliver the right amount of abatement, which for me plays into exactly the issue. And so reading the difference in the IPCC reports 5 years apart, if you previously thought on the basis of threats that 3 degrees was safe, on this, the current report, you would probably think 2 degrees is safe. If you thought 2 degrees was safe now, it's probably shifted down to 1.5 degrees. The science is saying that the threats are becoming nearer term and more severe than we thought a short while ago. So, Warwick, that makes me worry when you draw a single curve and say that's the long-run commitment. We're going to commit on the basis of current knowledge to a target that's 93 years away. Given that background uncertainty and given that adjusting on the basis of Monash modelling carbon prices, adjusting from a 60% reduction to a 65% reduction the permits already in the market, buying those back is $2 billion a year if we've got the target wrong. How do you pick that target, and on what basis, and what's the mechanism for adjusting it if we get it wrong?
Okay, Steve, we've got two instruments here. We've got the long-term permits, which are in the market and have tied down the credible action we're trying to take. But we have the safety valve permits. We can ratchet up the short-term price within a very short period of time, which will make people upgrade the long-term price instantly, and therefore people will take even more concerted action. We can bring that target down any way we want with the short-term safety valve if we decide that the costs we're now willing to pay are much higher than they were yesterday. The second point is, even if the government is resistant ratcheting up the safety valve, the long-term market will respond instantly when the information hits it. This is a much more serious crisis than we thought, and the value of those long-term permits will shoot through the roof, and therefore all the alternative technologies will become more valuable, people will innovate, you move more quickly, and even though those permits are out there, that market at some point hopefully will disappear. Now, you can ratchet up the short-term price anytime you want. If you increase the safety valve price from 10 to 50, then all of a sudden the price of carbon in your economy is $50 today, and the future price will be far greater. So you can shift the yield curve around like we do with monetary policy.
You can discuss this with him afterwards, because we're into the next question's time.
Hi, Peter Burgess, Illumina Limited. I'm an engineer, so I bring an engineer's bias to this discussion. I've listened and been part of this debate, I guess, for a few years, and I hear the environmentalists looking at the environmental data with horror, I guess, and looking at what's happening to the world. They then look at, I guess, the economists, and you look at each other, and the economists sort of say, well, yes, that's terrible, and this is how much it's going to cost to fix. As an engineer, I look at the models that you've talked about and have been talked about here the last couple of days, and I wonder if they miss the vast power of human innovation to change things, because I think there's so many things we don't know about what we could do with different technologies once there is a price for carbon there. And I think I've spent my life forecasting various things, and I know how hard it is to forecast. So I just wonder if you'd comment on that. It seems to me that the tremendous power of innovation might be being missed in this discussion.
Gentlemen?
The reason though why you have a market price is because that doesn't steal the innovation. It allows the innovation to happen. Our proposal is not based on my model being correct. In fact, our proposal was designed because we couldn't work out in all the different models what an optimal trajectory would look like. We had to step back and say, how do you learn by doing? You create the markets, you create the everything's in place, and you move forward instead of negotiating and debating decade after decade. So you put in place the price signals. That futures market that I'll create, I think, will be a powerful driver of all sorts of innovations that we never could have understood. Again, go back to 1900 and ask the question, what would the energy systems of the world look like in 1950 or 1960? No one in this room would have got that remotely correct. And so you need to create the institutions and the incentives, not mandate and not target and not be very precise. It's a learning by doing strategy, and it's human innovation that's required.
Actually, I think that's an interesting engineering question, and economists fiddle around with their models, and there are models that have induced technical change, for example, embedded. But as the session talked about yesterday, that we're talking about uncertainty, I mean, it is very, very difficult, as you say, to know what technology might be out there in 2100. Now, having said that, though, there are only certain ways on the planet to generate energy. And there's a fair bit of interesting work coming down the pike about some of the technical and physical constraints on some of these energy sources. For example, I've heard a rumour that a paper will be coming out in Nature in a short while that gives you the physical limit on the amount of wind energy that you can generate on the planet. I mean, and those things are physical limits. And we can do the same sorts of calculations for solar. I mean, I heard during the discussion either this morning or yesterday, the notion that Europe was thinking about covering vast proportions of the Sahara with solar cells. Now that sounds like a good thing to do, there's also a few technical issues with that. Namely, that the Sahara at the moment is a fantastic reflector. It And as soon as you cover it with solar cells, effectively what you want to do is you want to absorb the solar energy. 10% of that will be turned into electricity, 90% of it will be turned into heat that you then keep on the Earth. Previously, it was reflected back into space. So there are some serious technical issues here that we have to deal with. I agree with you, we really haven't got a clue what will happen in the future, but at least if we do more science and do more and spend more money on worrying about the R&D and thinking about some of these problems, we're going to be a lot better off than we currently are.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I know there are more questions to ask these two guys, but...
Sorry, I've got a question over here.
Hands waved at me. I was only going to allow... Who are we going to give the question to? One more question. Okay, last question.
Thanks. Killian Wentrop from Origin Energy. Look, other than the setting of the cap, it would seem that one of the most interesting features of the scheme that's being developed here is the penalty mechanism, which kind of acts a little bit like Warwick's annual permits in the blueprint model. And the task group report was pretty vague in its language around describing, you know, what a soft start means and what relatively low price signal means and the rate at which the penalty sort of moves away from the marginal cost of abatement and so on. And as a result, over the last 6 months, people have been speculating on what those words mean. There was an article on Monday, I think, in The Australian suggesting that... you know, $30 a tonne was an extreme view and that $10 a tonne would be more likely. But to me at least, $10 a tonne seems like a bit of a waste of time. It would just be a tax essentially without much of a signal for investment. I was just wondering if the panel could comment on the appropriate role of that penalty as a safety valve mechanism and of the types of carbon prices that might actually be needed, even to get the initial low-cost abatement options into the system over, say, the next 10 to 15 years.
Yeah, very brief. It doesn't matter what the carbon price is today. You could have a $1,000 a tonne carbon price for 3 days and then have it go to zero, and it won't have any impact on anyone except very, very short term. What matters is the expected future carbon price. I've got no problem starting at 10, but very quickly ratcheting up through 50 and 60 over 5 to 10 years or 20 years, depending on what's happening in the rest of the world and what's happening in Australia. The second point is the penalty function that the task group has talked about and my system are identical in terms of there is a price cap. But the fundamental difference is if it's a penalty, like in the European trading system, it means the company that's involved in the transaction is a bad player. Whereas if it's a market transaction of buying a permit, the social implications are totally different. And I don't see why you want to turn a market transaction into a political football. And so I would just make it into what it is, and that is a safety valve permit purchase, not a penalty paid to the government for bad behaviour.